on to implementation issues. We might have them too. Javid?
All right, thank you. We will move on to paper 12A on accounting policy changes. In June, the board tentatively decided to amend IF 8 to lower the impracticability threshold for voluntary changes in accounting policies resulting from agenda decisions. The proposed threshold would include a consideration of the benefits and costs of applying the change retrospectively. The board asked us to further consider the proposed threshold and the accompanying application guidance. The discussion at the June meeting also highlighted a concern about the timing of application of accounting policy changes resulting from agenda decisions. So this paper also considers whether the board should address this matter. At the AFAS meeting in July, we asked members for their views on this project. Appendix A summarizes the feedback received. We will first consider the timing challenge posed by agenda decisions. Our analysis is outlined in paragraph 11 to 17. We recommend that the board does not undertake standard setting to address this matter. Rather, in explaining its rationale, the board could explain that it expects entities to generally have sufficient time to implement changes resulting from agenda decisions. We anticipate that this explanation would include something along the lines of the discussion in paragraph 11 of this paper. I would like to turn your attention to question 1 on page 10 and ask if you agree with our recommendation on the timing matter.
So the timing question first.
I'm sympathetic to the recommendation, but I have a concern going back that for a lot of preparers and organizations, this is a significant problem, and that some regulators are treating the agenda decisions as having significant weight, and I may not be sympathetic. And so what I was hoping was maybe we could do something that might be somewhat stronger or in addition to, that would reinforce the idea that it takes some time. I was wondering if it was possible to perhaps do something in the agenda decisions themselves. If we do the basis for conclusions, which may well be not that salient or not that available to a lot of people, if we put something in that just reminded people about the basis for conclusions on a regular basis, and also just sort of indicated something to the effect that, you know, you might say in suggesting that, you know, the agenda decision writes out its suggested approach, it might sort of write something to the degree that an entity looks at this approach and decides that it would like to alter the way it's doing its accounting. You know, we recognize that often making accounting change takes significant time, and we would recommend that entities take sufficient time to get it right or something, as per whatever. But I just think I'm really a bit worried that if we just do the basis, that it's just not going to be salient enough, and the thing is going to come floating back as a problem.
I'm sympathetic to Tom's point, but I just, if we put it in an agenda decision, does that help much? Because the agenda decision itself is not authoritative.
Anyway. Yeah, I think that's probably the challenge.
I think Francois, you'll cut it.
Yeah, thank you. I'm a bit on the same line as Tom. I think the timing issue has been raised as a significant one. And I agree with the staff that introducing some standard setting to ICE 8 might not be a wise decision, because basically you have a broad range of different situations. So if you have a standard, if you would grant a standard delay, you would probably not accommodate situations in the best manner. And in fact, I was indeed thinking of what could be included in the agenda decision itself. I understand totally that we don't want transition requirements because these agenda decisions are not authoritative. They're just shedding new light on the issues. But you could have some wording, such as, would this agenda decision trigger a voluntary change? Then the IFRIC thinks that implementation would require no less than, for example. And I mean, I don't want to move ahead with the other issues, but it could also provide some expectation, cautious expectations around the cost-benefit issue, so that it channels the decisions to be made a bit more without providing direct requirements. So that was my reaction.
Thank you. As Sue pointed out, agenda decision is not an authoritative decision. So as long as it is not an authoritative decision, so there isn't much we can do. So therefore, in this sense, I agree with staff's recommendation. However, question is, can we change the attitude of our regulators? Or can we change the attitude of auditors by providing some, explanation? Say, for example, if I look at the page 12, it says German representative said that the agenda decision can be viewed as effective immediately upon publication. So if that is their interpretation, so we have to say, this is not always the case. We have to think about preparation time for preparers and the agenda accounting policy change based on the agenda decision is a voluntary change. So therefore, a preparer can take time. That is our interpretation, and we have to disseminate it to regulators.
Amaro.
Thanks. In short, I agree with staff. I think we did enough for the reasons mentioned by TACA. It's not authoritative, and I actually think I actually disagree with TACA's suggestion of make more explicit our understanding or interpretation that this is necessary. This is not immediate. This takes time. I think market should adjust to that in accordance with regulators' expectation. My concern for that is that if we do indicate there is something different with agenda decisions, we actually could incentivize more submissions to the interpretation committee, because submissions, even if they know that the interpretation might be aligned with a particular practice, they will submit, because then they will be grandfathered to what they have been done or been doing. So this is my concern. I think the way it's working well. Agenda decisions, I think we decided in previous discussion, the board, to make it more prominent, more easier, accessible for people to know what was discussed. And I think that would be enough.
Gary.
Thank you. Actually, Mauro said most of what I was going to say. I actually agree with the staff. Think about the irony here. We choose to not take any action, explain why you didn't take any action, and then we say, if there is any effect, it's voluntary. I mean, it's sort of hard to do much with that. And I have other comments similar, the question two when we get to it. So I think the process is working fine. If we want to, and the basis of conclusion is the agenda decisions or whatever, we want to explain that thinking why it doesn't have to be immediate or we expect normal lead time or something like that, I think is more than sufficient. So I agree with your recommendation.
I agree with the recommendation in question one. And I think a lot of this is about the relationship between the companies and their regulator. And we've heard that it varies, this relationship. So I think we'd be going on to dangerous ground to try and have something in an agenda decision that directs, given the voluntary nature that's been referred to, that directs how this is going to work in a jurisdiction. I think it belongs within the jurisdiction for the entity and the regulator.
So I agree with where staff's landed, and I think when I put my Toblerone up, I think the conversation was going one way. It's now turned to some extent the other way. I think we had two paths that we could go down. The one path was to leave the existing voluntary and error as the two types of things that could be. The other path was to create a bespoke type of authoritative space. I think we decided we don't want a bespoke authoritative space. That means that we're relying entirely on what would happen in a voluntary circumstance. There are plenty of voluntary circumstances over and above agenda decisions where a company may, somebody said, shed new light on the topic that they were considering, where you get new information. We don't provide guidance on any of those. I think what we're relying on is the fact that this is shedding new light on the situation, and the entity now applies the normal voluntary thing, which is they make the change in the time they believe appropriate. I think anything we add beyond the idea that we see it in that way starts to create this hazy notion that it's something different again. And I think in particular any special guidance we give or something like that is sort of putting it into its own little box again. And I think having decided we don't want to do that, I think we should carry through with it all the way.
One aspect in the discussion on this issue that led me think that we could not simply rely on regulators is to learn about the diversity of reactions over the world by regulators to agenda decisions, ranging from the regulator that just let people do whatever they like, moving on to the regulator that says everything is a correction of an error, moving on to another regulator that will decide that this has to be, in fact, implemented as soon as published. So if we want consistent application and if we want people to implement our standards in a way that fosters high quality, we need to be taking care of how things are being implemented in practice, make sure that appropriate time is provided. So if we don't do that, if we want to keep to the recommendation that is widely supported around this table, then I think we have to get to a form of memorandum of understanding with the regulators on how to deal with these issues and find a way of harmonizing and getting everybody on the same understanding and making sure that proper implementation conditions are going to be granted to entities and their auditors.
I share the concerns that some raise about how helpful will really be for preparers if we just sort of acknowledge that we think that a reasonable period of time should be allowed for people, because I think the reality is these are different to other voluntary changes. I think the reality in many jurisdictions is it's not really so voluntary because regulators and audit firms get involved and sort of impose it. And it's all very well for us to sort of say on the basis that we expect that a reasonable period of time should be allowed, but if a regulator comes along and says you have to do it today, then they've got nothing that helps them. So I feel like we need to do something more than just acknowledging this, because I don't really think it's going to provide the help that we are hoping to provide. Now, having said that, I'm a bit stuck in terms of what the form of that help is, because even though I think it's sort of attractive to make an observation in an agenda decision, given that it's not authoritative in its own right, I'm not sure how helpful that will be in practice. I had a conversation with Javid where I actually suggested something like what Francois just suggested, which would be at a minimum, surely, if all we were doing was this sort of reference, that we'd have to work with regulators to sort of, you know, explain what our expectations were and see if we could work together to sort of make sure that people were given a reasonable period of time so the system works the way that we intend. Or, given that we are actually, even though people have mentioned that, you know, we shouldn't give these special type of voluntary changes a special status, we sort of already are with what we're proposing in the second question and the decision we made last time. We've already sort of singled out voluntary decisions that are coming as a consequence of agenda decisions as special voluntary changes in policy, in which case that presumably gives us an opportunity to come up with something specific to express our expectations or about the timeliness of application actually in the body of IESA. And I don't know what it would say, but given we're already scoping this out for something, why not extend that benefit to help with the timing of application?
Mary?
Sorry, I'm just processing Sue's comments, but I think I still land where the staff recommendation is. The points I take away from the different remarks made is it's, I think, first of all, it's important to move ahead with this project broadly, and I'm glad the staff has brought it back so fast and we're making progress. I think we do have kind of a delicate balancing act, you know, with the voluntary nature of the of changes in response to non-authoritative guidance. And frankly, you know, Sue, you said the reality is that these voluntary changes are maybe not so voluntary. I think what that points to is what we're trying to do is legislate about kind of environmental, you know, the whole environment and how things work in different people's expectations. So I tend to fall on the side of the staff recommendation and say that that does, however, give several things we should do. Is one, we've got to make a particular point about outreach to auditors and regulators during the time the comment period is out, picking up on the notion that those are kind of the ones who are going to make or break whether this works as we intend. Second, I think we need to be vocal about expressing our views about the timing. Elsewhere. So we're kind of conditioning the environment. And I think because we're trying to get to a healthy ecosystem. And I think we do have relationships with all of the parties involved, both formal and informal. And it's time to work those and see if we can get everybody on the same page. I think I then would put maybe in connection with this question, put in a question in the invitation to comment that basically says, do you think this is enough or do we have to, kind of what Sue was saying, find a way to embed our expectations about timing in ISA itself, but I would hope that we could get away without doing it. And last thing I'd say is about the point that Amaro raised, a concern of if we go too far down this, are we going to encourage a flood of submissions asking questions to get air cover for correction of an error? And I think the point, again, this comes back to our communication about expectations. To date, we've had, I think, sincere submissions to the interpretation committee, and that if we start getting some that appear to be that the interpretation committee has to be able to say, we think the requirements are clear and are clear. And I think when they say the requirements are clear, that's a signal that there's correction of an error. And I think they have to remind people that they have that in their toolkit. And that's how I think we counterbalance the risk of this mechanism being abused. I don't think it needs to go in the document, but I think that comes back to this is more about having something to communicate around.
Martin.
Yeah, I not agree with the staff recommendation here because I think, and as others said, I think it is a gray area between voluntary change in accounting policy and correction of an error. If it is more in a correction of an error, then we are saying, okay, we allow sufficient time, but if I would be a regulator, I would not allow sufficient time, I would say do it immediately. So in this kind of circumstances, I think that is also productive, because then people can go back to the regulator and say, but the ISB thinks I have 1 year time before I correcting this error through a voluntary change in accounting policy. On the other hand side, I think if it should be really helpful, I think we should do some standard setting if it is really a voluntary change in the policy. So I'm not a decider, but I think would do nothing or do really standard setting, but I think this is really not helpful, not to anybody. And especially if it is close to correction of an error, because I think if it's close to correction of an error, I should do it immediately and not waiting 1 year implementation time.
Mary?
I just want to come back, because Martin, you said you think it's in the gray zone, and I was nodding, yeah, between voluntary change and then you say correction of an error, and then I'm like, no. I think I would hope there are relatively few circumstances when somebody would have an extreme enough version of one of the alternatives considered, that it starts to get into a gray zone about correction of an error. To me, I think it's maybe gray zone between voluntary versus not voluntary because it verges on authoritative. But I think there may be always some outliers at the periphery of a substantive issue discussed that maybe for them it's a question. But I think to date the submissions to the interpretation committee have been genuine in terms of differing readings, and I'd hope we could continue with that. So I don't so far see them as verging on correction of errors.
All right.
Can I add something?
Yeah, sure.
Well, in fact, even if we have expressed different views on the issue, we, not necessarily everyone, but we tend to agree that there would not be any standard setting within ICE itself. So we could agree the staff recommendation and nevertheless look into the issue further. Mm-hmm. On what to be done on this timing issue.
But I think it's right to say that maybe, yeah, it's good to vote on the question, I think, and decide whether to do or not. And then if the decision is, say, if is that, say, to follow the recommendation and we won't propose some change to IS 8, we could put to a vote at least some of the thinking maybe Mary had about, I mean, first of all, by the way, because of this discussion, the basis to the exposure draft should explain that properly and have a proper discussion about it so people can comment. And I think also we could talk about actually highlighting it more and maybe having a specific question about this in the exposure draft that would
be great.
Highlight the basis of things. So that's all.
Okay. Who agrees with the staff recommendation?
And also to say that I think, well, I don't know whether we put it to a vote or not, but I think we would take forward that we'd make sure we have a complete sort of explanation of the board's discussion and the basis, and that we'd also add a specific question.
Yeah. On this topic. I don't think we need to vote.
Voting on the basis.
Yeah.
Okay. I will move on to the proposed threshold. Our analysis is contained in paragraph 19 to 27 of the paper. We recommend that the proposed threshold include consideration of not only the cost to an entity, but also the benefits to users of applying the change retrospectively. For the reasons outlined in our analysis, we think considering benefits is an essential part of the threshold. Paragraph 27 outlines our suggestion as to what the board could include in application guidance. I would now like to turn your attention to questions 2 and 3 on pages 10 and 11 and ask whether you agree that the new threshold is a cost-benefit threshold and ask for your views on our suggestions in paragraph 27 for inclusion of application guidance.
Sue?
I agree with where you're heading with this in terms of the explanation of how the assessment is made and this whole idea of having this sort of assessment be made in the hands of the preparers, if you like, but with guidance around how that assessment would be made. But I guess one thing that struck me when I looked at the materials that you'd extracted from our existing literature that had this sort of context built out, it tended to be a test of whether there was undue cost or effort as opposed to an explicit benefit versus cost assessment. And I know that in some forums, including ASAF, a concern came up about how difficult it might be to assess the benefits from a preparer's perspective and whether looking at the cost side of the equation was the easiest side of the equation. So I just was interested why the staff decided to not go with an undue cost or effort wording and start with a benefit versus cost proposal.
Yeah, I think on that issue for undue cost or effort, we did look at that term, and I think it was discussed around the board table last time as well, that the notion of undue probably implies some level of consideration of the benefits as well. And looking at all the recent transmission reliefs that the board has provided, the focus has been more on the benefit side of the equation. So we thought that was very essential to include the benefits. And in terms of using the term undue cost and effort, we try to stay away from that, mainly because in the minds of some, if we just say undue cost and effort, it might reduce the importance of considering benefits, so we just thought it's safer. And also because the term is used in other places like IFRS 9, I think we thought that if we use the same term and provide specific application guidance in this area, that it might spill over into other areas where we use the same term, and there could potentially be some unintended consequences. So we just thought it was safer to just explicitly mention the cost and benefits.
And also, just to be clear, you also didn't think that we would mean, if we didn't have the specific word benefit there, you could ignore it anyway.
Correct, yes.
John. Thank you very much. Just as one simple editorial comment, maybe, on that question 2B, you said the cost of determining those are effects that outweigh the benefits of this, blah, 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 applying the new accounting policy retrospective. So what I'm saying is there some difference between the cost of determining those effects and the cost of the new accounting policy retrospective?
It's not different. This is getting at the cost of applying the policy retrospectively, but it's just getting more specifically at identifying what effects it costs you more to determine, and based on that then you decide where in the hierarchy of retrospective application you fall. So for example, paragraph 23 to 27 outline what you do in case you can't determine either the cumulative effects or the period specific effect, and it takes you through a chain of how far back in time do you have to go, depending on what you can and cannot determine. So this is just trying to stick to that principle. But in effect it's really talking about retrospective about the cost of applying the chain retrospectively. But it's just sticking to the framework in IF8.
Yes, yeah. Understandable, but generally other standards, when they say the cost of something, then generally, there's, in your appendix, you collect many good examples there. So for example, if you see page 15, at the paragraph B2, the board decided that although retrospective applications generally impose increased preparation costs, those costs, the terminology. The cost is generally used in other standards, just applying something rather than determining some specific effects of this kind of thing. That's what I'm saying, the terminology is quite different. Another thing is whether there might be some substantive difference between these two terminologies. That's what I'm concerned with, that's what I'm asking.
No, we can consider that in drafting.
Yeah, I think just the main point and the reason maybe for that difference, I think, between, say, the example you highlighted, Chung-Wu, is, I suppose, the example you highlighted is an explanation in the basis about cost or benefits for the board's decision. I think the way we've kind of worded how we'd view this happening is it's the wording that we put into IS8, and I suppose what at least we've been doing is try to word that as closely to what's already in IS8, in a sense, because that what we're trying to do is not fundamentally change IS8, in a sense. Just say that, so today in IS8, you've just got the only reason for not applying retrospective application is to say if there's an impracticability, via an impracticability threshold, and then there's a kind of a process in ISIT that you follow if that's the case. So all we're trying to do here is insert a kind of new threshold but not change anything else. So just saying if you meet this new threshold or don't meet the new threshold, then you simply fit into the other parts of IS8, and because of that we're trying to word it as closely to what's already in IS8.
And to that I'd just add that the requirements in ISA, what we are trying to say is that it's not just an on-off switch. You're not either just retrospective or prospective. It's more an analysis of how far back can you go, and you should go back. The danger if we use the words the cost of applying the chain retrospectively is that people would think of it more as an on-off switch, and either you do full retrospective or you do prospective, whereas it's more along a scale of how far back do you go. So.
My sense of this is there are a lot of behavioural issues at play in what we're discussing here. In that respect, just going back to Sue's point about benefits or versus undue costs and efforts, for me it's essential to explicitly mention benefits in here rather than just leave it as being more implicit. And that also seems to be consistent with the application guidance that we've looked at, thinking about both costs and benefits.
Gary.
Thank you. I also support the staff's recommendations. I think it was said by a few people here in response to the question when we really have subdivided voluntary changes, those originated by the reporting entity, their own volition, and those sort of originated for them, not by us, but by intermediaries between us and the preparer. So I think that's exactly what's happened here. So the question is, should it get a different strata of decision tools, you know, from if you're doing it on your own? Well, if you're doing a voluntary change on your own, besides can you do it, the impracticality, and is it worth doing it, you know, the cost, efforts versus benefits, you'd have to also demonstrate that the preferability is there as well. But the preferability has been sort of decided for you in certain jurisdictions are saying these are authoritative guidance. So I think with all that put together, I think the thresholds, I think it probably should be a little bit lower threshold, or the, as you put it in here, or a different threshold, I guess lower, higher, sort of depends on which side you're looking at it from. So I think we've sort of got the right guidance in here for it. I agree with Nick. I think you do have to demonstrate the benefits, you know, are not as great as the costs or level of effort. And benefits are, they're not necessarily always quantitative. It's also educating your users and so on. It's all part of it. And then I think because we're sort of introducing a new type of voluntary change that's not quite so voluntary, I think the recommendations in question three that you should give guidance how to do it, I think is just a natural extension of that decision. So I support you.
I like what I just took from Gary's comment about maybe we should title this exposure draft not quite so voluntary changes as is the title for the ED. But more substantively, I wanted to say that I again to echo Nick's comments about it. I think it's really important to talk about benefits as well as costs. I think this exercise was instructive to me in terms of thinking about costs and benefits. I learned about it. I think the times that the board makes cost-benefit decisions and we say it's up to us, not individual entities, is when we're trying to transition a whole system from one thing to another, and we make kind of a global cost-benefit determination when we set the transition. But I think the staff hit the nail on the head when you said in paragraph 22, you explained why we should be expect individual entities in this situation to make a cost-benefit determination, because it's the same kind of understanding of the users of their the needs of users of the financial statements that we expect them to gain to make materiality decisions. So I think making that link is a really good point about why we expect in these circumstances users to be able to. So support the staff recommendation for cost-benefit as the basis. The other, just a couple of ideas to throw out. I think it's helpful to have factors discussed, and you outline them in the 21 to 27. I'm not sure we need every one of them, but I would suggest taking a look at organizing them maybe as a table that gives more and less importance to retrospective, and I think it might just help people see it as a continuum a bit more. And the last thing, and it struck me from looking at the examples that you had excerpted at the end, is in a few places the board has said, considering kind of at a global level the cost and benefit, don't do any of the things we have in IS-8. Do, a fourth or fifth or sixth thing instead. We maybe need to make the point that we're limiting people to fitting into ISA, not using cost-benefit to make up a variant of their own, the way, you know, that's the extra freedom we reserve for ourselves.
I agree with what has been, with the staff recommendation and also with what has been said about the need to have the benefits. So I'm not going to repeat that. Nevertheless, I mean, I'm still concerned that there will be, in practice, very diverse assessments made. And this is why I had thought that it would be better to kind of channel in one way or another these assessments at the frequent decision stage, at least give a flavor. I mean, there can still be differences and own judgments made depending on specific circumstances, but I would have wanted the assessment to be channeled from the standard setter.
Thank you.
First of all, I agree with the staff's recommendation. And second, it's relevant to the threshold. So I think we should make it as clear as possible. When I look at the wording, the suggestion to be is that is the cost simply would outweigh the benefit is enough? Or if I look at the wording at 27A, the cost should be substantially exceed the benefit. So it's a different threshold. Or cost outweigh the benefit, or should substantially exceed the benefit. And secondly, that there are two wording. The benefit is the benefit itself, or it should be the expected benefit, because we're using different word. Expect benefit of, I prefer expect benefit.
Yes. Yes.
It's useless benefit. For prepare, it's very difficult to decide, to make judgments. So it's just the expected benefit. Right. So I should, another thing I'm a little bit worried, because that although it's not authoritative, but sometimes once a general decision come out, we always hope prepare to use that decision if the original policy they use is wrong, different from our agenda decision. The problem is that when they're using cost-benefit analysis, maybe they can say the benefit is so slow and the cost is so high. But well, they will not rush to use that decision. It's not what our direction wants to do. So maybe in some way we should mention this kind of cases to have the preparer really use our agenda decision correctly and consistently.
I agree with the staff's recommendations generally in here. Just a couple of thoughts. Because we are so prone to coming up with bespoke transition requirements, I had to reread IS8 to remind myself exactly what it said. And one thing that I'd sort of overlooked and was reminded about was the fact that it's not even so much about whether it's prospective versus retrospective, it's also about restatement of comparatives. So I think it's good to make it very clear what exactly it is that they're deciding they have to do in terms of, you know, it's all of those assessments that we're talking about, because and not, you know, so just to spell out exactly what the decision is and so what the alternatives are, if you like, on the scale, the spectrum. And Francoise made a good point, which is that if we hand over this sort of cost-benefit assessment to preparers, which I agree with, we will have situations where people make different assessments. And I wonder whether it's worth reminding people that if it was something material, that this might be a sort of significant judgment type area where we might expect to see disclosures around how they've made this assessment. So why it would be the case when it would seem that it would be a very important change for them to make, that they've come to a different conclusion, would be something that might be interesting to users. I'd hope we wouldn't have to come up with a specific disclosure requirement, but there's already stuff in the standard disclosures that maybe it's worth mentioning.
Okay. Can I see the agreement of recommendation? Oh.
Everyone.
Okay. Thank you. We will move on to Agenda Paper 12B on the amendments to IFRIC 14 and IS 19. I will first talk about the IFRIC 14 amendments. As background, IFRIC 14 clarifies how much of a surplus an entity can recognize as an asset. Paragraph 11 of IFRIC 14, which is reproduced in Appendix C, specifies that an entity has an unconditional right to a refund in three situations. Proposed paragraph 12A of the amendment aims to clarify that an entity cannot assume gradual settlement when other parties have particular settlement rights. In these situations, an entity would generally assume full settlement. So why does this matter? It matters because the measurement of the asset assuming full settlement is different from its measurement assuming gradual settlement. So this amendment could result in some plans recognizing a significantly smaller asset and could also result in some portions of minimum funding requirement contribution being recognized as a liability. In July, we informed the board about the possible effects of the IFRIC 14 amendments on defined benefit plans in the UK. Paragraph 11 summarizes findings from other jurisdictions, which confirm that the amendments are not expected to have a significant effect outside the UK. The amendments would lead to consistent outcomes for defined benefit plans with the same terms and conditions. Nonetheless, we are not certain yet that the benefits would outweigh the cost. We understand it might be possible for entities to make non-substantive changes to their plans that could eliminate or substantially reduce the effects of the amendments. This would, in turn, reduce much of the expected benefit from these amendments. So we are asking whether you agree that we should do some further work to see whether it might be possible to develop amendments that might build on the underlying principle in paragraph 11 of IFRIC 14. If you agree regarding IFRIC 14, then we recommend finalizing the IS 19 amendment separately from those on IFRIC 14. I would now like to turn your attention to question 1 on page 5 and ask if you agree with our recommendation.
I agree with the staff recommendation, because it seems that we're at risk of making a change that might only be really relevant in one jurisdiction where non-substantive changes might mean that that change has little effect anyway, so we disrupt the system with a risk of no benefit. So, and really at the heart of what we started off looking at was this question of whether or not it was appropriate to be recognising assets in particular circumstances, which seems more consistent with this area of focus that you're suggesting we do some more research on. So I'd agree with your recommendation.
Gary. Thank you. Actually, I don't agree with the recommendation. I think we know enough now. I mean, pension plans, you know, you're a different beast, you know, because they affect employees, their compensation, they tend to be highly regulated. I tend to think you don't easily make non-substantive changes. For that matter, you don't easily make substantive changes. I think I think they're very sensitive instruments to the workforce. So I think what would be so hard about saying, you know, that like elsewhere in other standards, we say, you know, non-substantive, non-genuine changes don't count. What would, you know, be so hard about saying the basis right now or someplace in the document that we would expect any changes or substantive affect large portions of the workforce or large portions of the plan liability or something like that? So I suspect that would be the principle and might be very well we would come out if we did more work, and I just think we could probably do that now. It's not the end of the world if we delay this, but if we did more work, what sort of time frame or level of effort are you thinking? Even though I don't support doing more work, but it would be helpful to know what you're thinking.
Yeah, no, I think if the board agrees and lets us do further work, we would obviously prioritize the work that we do on the IFRIC 14 amendments, and I would expect at this stage to probably bring back something to you before the end of the year on where we would have explored what we could do and what our possible options are. And if we think that's not feasible, then we might just come back to you and say, no, we still see benefits in finalizing these amendments. So I would expect within the next couple of months or so, we would bring something back to you.
Well, what would you still expect to, when you say you don't agree, what would you expect to learn next couple of months? Presumably you got a problem you're bothered about, you know, but it just sort of drops in the paper. We think we need to do more work. What do you expect to learn?
Well, I suppose let's make sure we try and come back to that, Gary, if I don't answer that, because I'll just go back on your first point first of all, okay. And then try to roll forward on that one, is that I suppose one of the issues, I think, that as you say, well, you know, why here now? Are we almost saying just maybe take a pause, have a look wider before moving forward in this? And I think part of the issue we have is that the way IFRIC 14, that paragraph 11 of IFRIC 14, which is an appendix D to the paper, if you want to look, the way it's worded, it's quite strictly worded when it talks about the full settlement categories. It talks about full settlement of plan liabilities in a single event. So I think that the way that was worded, and obviously when we, you know, so it's worded quite, I suppose, strictly, meaning that anything that is not powers just for full settlement in a single event, we understand gets treated as sort of assuming gradual settlement. And I suppose at least in the amendments, what we were asked that led to these amendments to IFRIC 14 was really just a sort of a very narrow clarifying question around those words, and at least in what we, you know, the clarifications that were suggested didn't propose any change really, I suppose, to that notion of full settlement in a single event. It just, you know, it just clarified when, you know, sort of more words around that in a sense. So it didn't propose to change that sort of very strict differentiation between when you assume full settlement versus when you assume gradual settlement.
When we react to this, it might subterfuge my view of proceeding now, but so what's your definition of a single event? Is it the one check written from the trust to what annuities from? But I could see a very common situation use of pension plans when you're doing restructurings is you know, the acronym would be a V followed by an I, which I mean a voluntary reduction in force. People want to leave, get the chance to opt in, and you settle with them. But the same decision said if we're going to involuntarily reduce everybody else or a defined number. And so is that two events, a voluntary reduction force followed by involuntary, or is it one event, the decision, that one will follow the other, but it really is two steps of execution. So you know, that might argue we should do more work, but I would argue that's one event.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know if Anna or Jeff, but so I think that at the minute, as I say, the words are full settlement in a single event, i.e. as a plan wind-up. So at least those words kind of apply that. I won't make comments sort of off the cuff on sort of your scenario of maybe if it happens sort of, you know, the two in contemplation, but at least what that implies is that in this case, and what the amendment did was talk about where, say, trustees or another party to the entity had rights that said they could basically, you know, effectively wind up a plan, fully settle in a single event, and when that could happen. In any scenario where, say, trustees or others have any other rights, they could have rights to, you know, to gradually settle, to maybe settle whole sections of the plan, etc. That wouldn't be caught by full settlement. It was only where it really did happen in a single event, because those are the words in IFRIC 14, and the amendment was just clarifying that line.
Settlement to me implies writing the check, you know, as opposed to the decision to get to that point, you know, again. Maybe I'm talking myself into agreeing with the staff, but I'm still going to probably vote no, because I still think we need help.
Yeah. And I suppose the difficulty, and by the way, I think David is right, we can only give you a rough time frame. So I think that, I suppose, as we've learned more information, it at least convinced us right now that maybe it is just worth, you know, yeah, just pausing and having a bit of a look wider. To your point, I think it's an important one to say, well, what does this mean? You'll come back to us in a year's time having, you know, travelled all over the world and talked to everybody about their plans. And I think that the idea here is that what we're exploring is just still within the context of IFRIC 14 and even this paragraph 11 and sort of is very much trying to say we're still looking narrowly at pensions. This is not sort of a backdoor way of opening up all of IS 19 and everything else. We're just trying to focus on this scenario that talks about,
you know, how you determine the asset you recognise in the context of getting refunds. So wider than the amendment was focused, not really wide. In saying that, as we say, I think quite honestly in the paper, is that, you know, knowing all the questions there have been in the past around IS 19, how difficult it is, we, without doing something more, we're still not certain whether it's actually feasible to go a bit wider, but still keep that sort of manageable, that something could be done, you know, in an efficient time frame. But I think, as Javed said, so our plan is to do some more work, not to say the ends of the earth, and we would hope that at least we'd have something to bring back to you probably before the end of the year that at least feeds back to you on what we find.
Mary?
I support the staff looking again at this rather than us moving forward to finalise, and if we're taking IS 19 separately. As I look at the, you know, look through the paper, look at Appendix D and the excerpt from IFRIC 14, I think that the amendment that we proposed and redeliberated falls into the trap of looking too narrowly at parsing a subparagraph of a sentence. And, you know, and I think we're falling into the trap, and that means that the amendment we're making will not be effective because we've given, you know, we're giving people too tightly defined a response to the question, because I think, and this is something Sue alluded to, we're failing to focus on the opening statement of principle in this paragraph, that a refund is available only if the entity has an unconditional right to a refund. And we have really been focused on a when are you in B and C, and as opposed to stepping back and saying, how does this scenario fit into the notion that the entity has an unconditional right to a refund. So I think looking at whether we can do something that hooks more on that than the narrow clarification of when should you apply mechanics B versus mechanics C would be a more substantive response to the question that came in. So I encourage the staff looking to see whether that is doable without opening the whole can of worms. And so that's, I think, the kind of assessment and outreach I'd ask you to do rather than talking to many people.
Thank you. We'll now discuss the due process steps on the IS 19 amendment, which are outlined in paragraph 18 to 29. Questions 2 to 5 are on page 9. I will now hand over to the board and ask if you agree with questions 2 to 5.
Yes?
Yes.
The whole thing, huh? Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Maria with his fault.
All right, in the process. Come.
Yes, thank you. We will move on to agenda paper 12C, which set out the due process steps the board has taken for the annual improvement 2015 to 2017 cycle. The exposure draft for this annual improvement cycle included three proposed amendments, amendment to IS 12, amendment to IS 23, and amendment to IS 28. In its deliberation, the board tentatively decided to finalize the amendment to IS 28 separately as a narrow scope amendment. The board also tentatively decided to finalize the amendment to IS 12 and IS 23 with some clarifications. In addition, in April, the board tentatively decided to finalize the proposed amendment to IFRS 3 and IFRS 11 that related to accounting for previously held interest. As explained in paragraph 12 to 13, we think the amendment to IFRS 3 and IFRS 11 meets the criteria for annual improvements. We suggest finalizing them as part of the annual improvement cycle together with the amendment to IS 12 and IS 23. I would like to direct your attention to the questions on page 6 and ask whether you agree with our recommendation.
Yes, we do.
Well, dissent is separate. Does any board member intend to dissent? No? Then we all agree with all questions. Yeah? All right. Thank you. So that's the answer. Different questions. Shall we take a 15-minute break?